On the Necessity of Uniting Prayer with Performance for the Success of Missions by Thomas Chalmers. Had the members of some school of philosophy, by dint of a skillful and laborious analysis, become profoundly conversant with the mysteries of the human spirit, had they speculated with accuracy and effect, not merely on the progress of an individual mind from its first rude and unformed elements to the highest finish both of its moral and intellectual cultivation, but also on the progress of the collective mind in society, so as to trace all the continuous footsteps by which the transition is made from savage to civilized life? Had they, on the principles of their new system, devised a path of tuition and instituted a method of discipline and framed a book of elementary doctrine and scholarship, in virtue of which they held themselves prepared for a grand philanthropic experiment on some remote island of barbarians, yet in the ferocity and primitive ignorance of nature, had they been able so to interest the public in their scheme as to be upheld by them in all the cost of a benevolent expedition, and then set forth on the wide ocean of adventure till they reached a far distant and solitary shore that was peopled by an untaught tribe of idolaters, where all the arts and habits and decencies of Europe were unknown, and where some hideous, misshapen sculpture bespoke a paganism of the coarsest and most revolting character? Had they, in these circumstances, offered parley with the natives, and gained their confidence, and won such an ascendancy, as that they could assemble and detain them at pleasure for the purposes of education, and, furnished as they were by an enlightened metaphysics with the best and fittest lessons for men in the infancy of understanding, brought their well-weighed processes to bear upon them? Had they got pupils from among all their families, and in 20 years wrought a change more marvelous than 20 centuries, rolling over the head of many tribes and nations of our world, have been able to accomplish? In a word, had they transformed this horde of cannibals into a lettered and humanized peasantry, and for the cruelties of their old and haggard superstition, trained them to the peaceful charities of this world and to the rejoicing hopes of another? Had they been further enabled to grace the whole of this exhibition by such pleasing and picturesque accompaniments as those of newly formed villages and cultivated gardens and prosperous industry and the whole costume of industrious and well-regulated life? And all this on the part of a people who but a few years before were prowling in nakedness, and with fierce and untamed spirit could assemble in delighted multitudes around the agonies of a human sacrifice. An achievement so wonderful as this would have blazoned forth upon the world as one of the noblest triumphs of philosophy. It would have filled and dazzled the whole of our literary republic, and her academies would have vied with each other in heaping their orders and their honorary titles on the men who had found out that specific charm by which to reclaim the wilds of humanity and to quicken a hundredfold the march and improvement of our species. Now, it is not very many years ago since such an enterprise was set on foot by the members of a certain college, though not a college of literati, and they carried out with them a certain book of instructions, though not one philosopher had to do with the composition of it, and they made the very attempt which we have now specified, on a territory removed by some thousands of miles from the outskirts of civilization, and through a severe ordeal of ridicule and of reverses did they ply their assiduous task, and have now brought their experiment to its termination. And whatever the steps of their process may have been, there is many an eyewitness who can speak to the result of it. The island of Otaheite, which teemed with the worst abominations of savage passion and savage cruelty, was the selected arena on which they tried the virtue of their peculiar specific, and, whatever the rationale of its operation may have been, there is no doubt as to the certainty of the operation itself. The savages have been humanized. The rude and hideous characteristics of the savage state have all disappeared. A nation of gross and groveling idolaters has become a nation of rational and kindred and companionable men, and, furnished now as they are with a written language and having access by authorship and correspondence to other minds and other countries than their own, do the lights of Christendom now shine full upon their territory. And it is indeed a wondrous transformation to look at their now modest attire and their now sweet and comfortable habitations, and their village schools, and their well-ordered families, and their infant literature, and their new-formed alphabet, and a boyhood just taught and practiced like our own in the various branches of scholarship, and what perhaps poetry, even though apart from religion, would most fondly seize upon of all. The holiness of their Sabbath morn, and the chime of its worship bell now breaking for the first time on the ear of the delighted mariner who hovers upon their shore, and recognized by him as a sound that was before unheard throughout the whole of that vast Pacific, in the solitude of whose mighty waters this island had lain buried and unknown for so many ages. Yes, all this has undoubtedly been done. But then a few gospel missionaries had the doing of it, and they tell us that the whole charm and power of this marvelous translation are to be found in the Bible and in its Kabbalistic orthodoxy. And they talk, moreover, of prayers and outpourings and mystic influences from on high, which all the science of all our universities cannot lead us to comprehend or in any way to sympathize with. And thus, as the compound effect of this whole exhibition on many spirits, are there an incredulity and a contempt, and at the same time an astonishment at a great moral phenomenon, the truth of which is forced upon them by the evidence of their senses. And withal, we fear, a still resolute determination to nauseate with all their might that peculiar evangelism which has been the instrument of the most gigantic stride that was ever made by barbarians on the road to civilization and virtue. And thus upon them do we perceive perhaps the most striking illustration of that text which can be given, who, when God worketh a work in their days, will in no wise believe, though a man should declare it unto them. But what they would not believe, they will be made to behold. Though still persisting in their contempt, it will be the beholding of despisers who wonder and perish. Now this appears to us the precise feeling of secular and merely scientific men in reference to Bible and missionary societies. These are the likely instruments under which the world will at length be Christianized, and by whose power we think that there are a stir and an aspect and a sort of heaving even now towards millennium. The instance just quoted is in itself a fine miniature exhibition of that which is destined at length to be universal. Like the size of a man's hand on a very distant horizon, but the token of a general rain, the clouds and magazines of which will spread over the whole firmament of heaven and descend in a universal shower on the thirsty world which is beneath it. The little stone is now distinctly visible to those who are looking for it, and from the visible it will rise into the conspicuous so as to obtrude itself at length on the notice of the contemptuous and the careless, and at last will attain to the size of a mountain that shall fill the whole earth. Meanwhile, Bible and missionary societies are now helping to build this spiritual Jerusalem, and much of most essential but unobserved groundwork must be done, ere the rising architecture shall be very discernible. And many are the laborers who must ply for years at the work of translations and the work of scholarship, ere the gospel shall be brought in its direct and naked force upon the consciences of the sinners in all nations. And assiduous must be the calls on the liberality of a Christian public to uphold this work of faith and of patience. And during the whole of its progress, the resistance and the ridicule of despisers are just what we should be prepared to look for. And accordingly, in spite of all the patronage that has descended on these institutions, still will we venture to affirm that the great majority of the cultivated intellect in our land is either in a state of contempt or in a state of hostility against them. That the charge of an obscure and ignoble fanaticism is still made to rest on the design and operation of these societies. That the example of success we have now quoted, which, had it been the success of a philosophical experiment, would have rung in high gratulation among all the savants of all the institutes in Europe, has, from its being the success of a Christian experiment, scarcely ever reached them. Or, if the report have fallen by accident upon their ears, it has been like the sound of a vague and distant something in which they had no concern. In short, there is an apathy about the whole enterprise, a cold and disdainful feeling towards the Christianization of the world. Now, though much of this is to be ascribed to man's natural enmity against the gospel of Jesus Christ, yet along with the dislike, there is an incredulity, and an incredulity that can allege for itself a number of seemly arguments. The most plausible of these is the utter inadequacy of the proposed means to the proposed end of the societies in question. It is to the spread of the Bible, and to the reading of the Bible, and to the charm of the preacher's voice when he urges home its lessons, it is apparently to these that they look for a regenerated species. To means so utterly insignificant, the end appears to be out of all measure romantic and impracticable and hopeless. This goes a certain way to explain the contempt of adversaries for the Bible enterprise. They do not see how this book of antique phrase and of hidden characters is to work so miraculous a change on the spirit and the moral habitude of nations. They cannot see by what inexplicable charm it is that the face of our whole world is to be so lightened and transformed by it. Like the enemies of Samson, they have not yet discovered wherein is that the secret of its great strength lieth. And all their ideas of its powerlessness are abundantly confirmed by what they see of its slender efficacy among our home population. When they look to the palpable exhibition of this book, lying neglected and unopened on the shelves of almost all our habitations, and notice how very small a space in the system of human affairs is taken up by the perusal of it, and estimate aright the wide distance which obtains between its spirit and the spirit of those who profess to own and to revere it, and see how, even in that very territory of Christendom, where the silence originated, it tells with no practical or perceptible influence on the mass of families, and can shrewdly remark, after all, that humanity, even in England, takes very much its own spontaneous way, and that really there seems no distinct or satisfying proof of any sensible control which the Bible has on its business, or its morals, or the general spirit and economy of its people, it is truly natural in these circumstances to ask, if the Bible have been of such minute and slender efficacy at home, by what inscrutable operation do we think that it is to achieve a transformation in every way so marvelous and so magical abroad? If, after the residence and the reading of centuries amongst us, the aspect of our present British society is still as distant as possible from that which we conceive of the aspect of millennium, how do we imagine that by the transportation of Bibles and missionaries into heathen lands, a new moral scenery is forthwith to emerge, and that the millennium of which we see no semblance immediately around us is first to break forth on some distant and unknown wilderness? It is thus that among men of firm and secular understandings there is a certain experimental feeling, as if the whole speculation were vain and visionary and most wildly extravagant. It is looked to as one of those delusive novelties that will have its meteoric course and then go into oblivion among the other popular follies which had their day and are forgotten. While the cry and fashion of the thing last, it is thought, money will be raised, and Bibles will be exported, and whole packages will be landed on the shores of idolatry, and missionaries will go forth and excite for a time a sort of marvel and interest among the natives at the very unusual kind of wares in which they deal and the strange proposals which they have to offer. But that, in a few little years, all will vanish into impotency, and leave not one trace behind of that fantastic crusade which we are now called upon to succor and to sustain. These are plausible discouragements, and they do operate with great force on nature and on the sagacity of natural men. They give a certain character of experimental wisdom to their opposition against that enterprise for which we are contending, and for the neutralizing of which, therefore, there is a peculiar importance in every fair example that can be quoted of missionary success. The experience of this success has greatly multiplied of late years, and meanwhile there are two distinct considerations that I would strongly urge for the purpose of sustaining your faith and the constancy of your friendship to the cause. The first consideration that I would urge is the certain fitness of the Bible to that object for which it has been framed. You must not forget that this book of doubted and decried and disowned efficacy is the Word of God, that it is a message constructed by Him and specially adapted by His wisdom to the special object of recalling a lost world from its state of exile and degeneracy. That such is declared to be the power of its doctrine, as that, whensoever it is received, there are received along with it the forgiveness of sin, an ability from on high to dethrone sin from its ascendancy over our moral nature. That, with this chosen instrument of God for the recovery of our fallen race, there is a capacity for all those high and heavenly purposes which it is destined to accomplish. That we are not to despair because of the long period of this world's resistance and this world's unconcern, for this is what the prophecies of the Bible itself have led us to anticipate, that meanwhile, and in the face of these prophecies, there is a precept of standing obligation to go and preach this gospel unto all nations, and to go and carry this message to every creature under heaven, and, finally, as the fruit of a patience that must weather every discouragement, and of a perseverance that must be manfully sustained amid the revilings of a whole multitude of scorners, and of a faith which against hope will believe in hope, that what God hath promised He is also able to perform, are we told of a latter-day glory which is to fill the whole earth, and that there is a veil which is to be lifted off from the eyes of all nations, and that another spirit will at length descend upon the world than that by which it has so long been actuated, and that the obstinacy of the human heart will at length give way under the assurances of redeeming mercy, so as that the gospel, now so unproductive of any moral or spiritual harvest, shall at length find free course and be everywhere glorified, turning the earth into a well-watered garden, and causing it from one end to another to abound in all the fair and pleasant fruits of righteousness. The second consideration that I would urge, for the purpose of sustaining our confidence in the future triumph and enlargement of this cause, is the efficacy of prayer. There is something in the whole temper and habit of philosophy that leads us to distrust the virtue of this expedient. There is even something in the philanthropic activity of our age that lures away the heart from its dependence upon God, and makes it confide to the powers of human agency alone that which never will be made to prosper without the hand of the Almighty being both acknowledged and implored in it. When one sees so many societies, with the skillful mechanism of their various offices and appointments and committees, and sums up the contributions that are rendered to them, and looks to the train of their auxiliaries all over the land, and hears the annual eloquence, and peruses the annual reports which are issued forth from the fountainheads of the whole operation, and further witnesses the spirit and agency and busy earnestness wherewith all their proceedings are conducted. So goodly an apparatus as this is apt to usurp the hope and the confidence which should be placed in God only. The instrument becomes an idol, and he who is jealous of his honor, and who will have the power of his divinity recognized throughout every step of that process which leads to the regeneration of our world, may choose to mortify the proud anticipations of those who calculate on their own strength and their own wisdom. The Christians who flourished in the days of Puritanism, that Augustan age of Christianity in England, were men of prayer, but not men of missionary performance. And the Christians of our present day are men of performance, but need perhaps to be humbled by crosses and adversities into men of prayer. It is out of the happy combination of these two habits that the evangelizing of the nations is to come. Both must go together, or no solid and enduring result will come forth of the experiment. It is by the neglect, either of the one or the other of these capabilities, that we explain the languid and stationary condition of the gospel for so many ages. And as the suggestion of some new expedient before unadverted to, like the breaking up of new ground or the opening of a tract before unexplored, raises the sinking hopes of a disappointed adventurer, so when the praying disciple is taught the necessity of labor, and the laborious disciple is taught the necessity of prayer, when these two elements meet together and cooperate as they did in the days of the apostles, when our men of devotion become men of diligence, and our men of diligence become men of devotion, it is from this union of humble hearts with busy hands that we would date the commencement of a new and a productive era in the Church's history upon earth. And we doubt not that what the old missionary Eliot reported and left on record of his own experience will be found true of the collective missionary experience of all ages, that it is in the power of pains and of prayers to do anything. And we do look on the example already quoted as a verification of this. We are old enough to recollect the high-blown spirit of adventure in which the first mission to Otaheite was undertaken, and with what éclat the missionary vessel went forth upon her voyage, as if the flags and ensigns of victory were already streaming in the gale. And with what éclat the missionary vessel went forth upon her voyage, as if the flags and ensigns of victory were already streaming in the gale. And with what eloquence were pictured forth all the chances, if not all the certainties, of success. We doubt not that many were dazzled into an earthly confidence when they looked to the complete equipment of all the human securities that were so abundantly provided for the accomplishment of this great enterprise. And he at whose disposal are all the elements of nature did carry it in safety to the shore. But he, at whose disposal also are all the elements of the moral world, taught by humbling experience that for these two he must be inquired after. And a cloud of disgrace and disaster hung for years over the enterprise, and the spirit which worketh in the children of disobedience stood its ground among the natives. And more woeful still, the spirit of apostasy made ravage among the missionaries themselves. And well can we remember the derision and the triumph of infidelity upon the misgiving of this sanguine speculation. We doubt not that many were effectually taught in the arts of patience and prayer by this fatherly correction, and led to look from the visible apparatus to the unseen guide and mover of it. And that there was a busier ascent of importunities to heaven, and a louder knocking than before at the door of the upper sanctuary. And certain it is that after a season of severe but salutary chastisement, an influence far too sudden and diffusive to be interpreted by any ordinary causes, came down upon the island, and by a miracle as stupendous as if it had been newly summoned from the deep, do we now behold it a land of genial dwelling places, the quiet and lovely home of a Christianized nation. It were now a topic by far too unwieldy, did we attempt to state the philosophy of prayer, or to meet the antipathies of those who have explored nature, and, as far as the light of science can penetrate, have found in all her ways a constancy that is inflexible. But you can at least be made to understand how it is that the study of this world's unvaried mechanism should have put to flight that host of living and supernatural agencies wherewith at one time it was held to be actuated. How after such an abundant discovery, as we now have of those trains and successions, that appear to be invariable and altogether to make up the history of our universe, the visions of the old mythology should all have been dissipated. Because, instead of each department in nature being ruled by its own presiding divinity, whom it is the part of superstition to implore, in each there are its own peculiar but steady and unchanging processes, which it is the part of philosophy to investigate, that thus the specters of a fabled imagery have now been swept away, and nature, instead of a haunted fairyland, is now regarded as the stable and everlasting repository of innumerable sequences, in whose rigid uniformity we see naught of the caprice of will, but all the certainty of mechanism. And so in this our enlightened day, there is no account taken of a spirit that resides in the thunder, or of a spirit in the air at whose bidding the storm might either be hushed or awakened, or of a spirit in the angry deep who might add to the wild uproar of the tempest by mixing his own element with that which is wielded by another potentate. The earth is now unpeopled of its demigods, and the substitution of the laws of nature in their place has often been extolled as the best service which philosophy has rendered to our species. You may now perhaps see by how likely and continuous a transition it is that men may pass from the extreme of superstition to the extreme of philosophical impiety. After that nature has been rescued by philosophy from the dominion of separate and subordinate deities, it may be placed by the same philosophy under the absolute and irreversible dominion of secondary causes. To guard this new dominion and make it inflexible, a supreme and eternal spirit may even be disowned, or, at all events, it might be reckoned indispensable that he never should put forth his hand on the regularities of that universe which he himself has established. It might be difficult to assign the place or the preeminence of such a god over his own workmanship, or to understand how he is admitted to a share in the government of his own world. But it is at least the imagination of many a philosopher that all must give way to the omnipotence and the certainty of nature's laws. The interposition of the divine will with these is utterly excluded from his creed. And the efficacy of prayer would be deemed by him a monstrous inroad on that constancy which he holds to be unalterable. It is thus that, along with the mythology of paganism, the theism of Christianity is apt to be swept away, and the system of nature is reduced to an economy of blind and unconscious fatalism. We are obviously on the confines of a subject that is greatly too ponderous for a single essay, and there is imperious necessity for limiting ourselves. Let us only then say further that it does not appear why an answer to prayer might not be given, and yet all the established sequences of our world be maintained in their wonted order as far back as philosophy can discover them. Instead of God dispensing with the secondary causes when he meets and satisfies our prayers, they may be the very instruments by which he fulfills them. When he hearkens to the supplication that ascends for a prosperous missionary voyage, he does not send forth a miraculous impulse upon the vessel, but causes the very wind to arise, which, by the laws of motion, should bear her onward to the destined haven. Even this wind might not be originated by miracle, but spring up from that previous condition of the air and the vapor and the heat, which, by the laws of meteorology, should cause that very gale to blow by which the service has been accomplished. And so to the uttermost limits of science, to the full extent of her possible observations, all might appear to move in strictly undeviating order. But still ulterior to this, and between the widest confines of all which nature can see upon the one hand, and that throne whence the author of nature issues forth his mandates upon the other, there is a hidden intermediate process which connects the purposes of the divine mind with the visible phenomena of that universe which he has created. And, not among the palpable things which lie in the region of observation, but among the secret things which lie in the dark and the deep abyss that is between the farthest reach of man's discovery and the forthgoings of God's will, it is among these, where that responsive touch may be given by the finger of the Almighty, which shall guide the mechanism of our world, and without thwarting any one of its laws. He moves those springs which be placed behind the curtain of sense and observation, and as he may thus, in subserviency to our prayers for the success of a missionary voyage, direct the processes of meteorology without deranging them, so in subserviency to our prayers for the success of missionary work, he may so direct the metaphysics of the human spirit in the whole business of conversion as not to violate any one of the laws or processes of human thought. It is thus that we may live under the canopy of a special providence, even on that platform of sensible things where all the trains and successions are invariable. It is thus that at the one and the same time we may be under the care of a presiding God and among the regularities of a harmonious universe. But after all, this contempt for prayer and for the doctrine of its efficacy is not more resolvable into a perverse philosophy than it is resolvable into irreligion, into that spirit of inveterate worldliness which is satisfied with things as they are and cares not for any transformation, which wants not the repose of nations to be disturbed by this restless and aggressive proselytism, and would rather that paganism were left to remain fixed as it has been for countless generations in its own deep, fixed, and rooted antiquity. They hate all innovation on the existing state of things, and as men will shut their eyes to avoid the spectacle of that which they dislike, so will they close their understandings against the light of that evidence by which it now becomes every day more manifest that we are on the eve of great moral and spiritual changes. that the world is heaving, in fact, towards some mighty and wondrous renovation, and that on the ruins of its present depravity there will at length be established an order of truth and charity and righteousness. This is all romance to the eye of their earthly understanding, and they will in no wise believe, though a man declare it unto them. And, despising as they do the gospel at bottom, they despise every account which reaches them of its progress. So that, when, instead of a report heard with the hearing of the ear, it reaches them in characters of nearness and authenticity, still, without the sympathy and without the discernment of its principles, they only marvel at what they cannot comprehend, and, looking on to a conversion of multitudes in which they do not partake, they wonder and they perish. Let me conclude with one or two brief sentences of personal application. Those who dislike any inroad to be made on the deep repose of heathenism, we would warn to be careful that they have not a dislike as violent to any inroad being made on the deep lethargy of their own souls. Those who think of friendly islanders and mild or peaceful Hindus that they stand in need of no transformation, let them tell whether they do not think the very same thing of themselves. They would rather that the heathen were let alone. And would they not rather that themselves were let alone also? And are they not as incredulous about the need of a regeneration for themselves as individuals as they are about the regeneration of a whole people? Is there not about them a general distrust of the whole matter? And would they not nauseate the ministers who speak to them of the conversion of their own spirit, just as honestly and heartily as they nauseate the missionaries who go forth to the conversion of idolaters and savages? Then let them know that life is passing away, and that in their state of nature there is a load of guilt unexpiated, of pollution unremoved, that there is but one specific for this disease all over the globe, and we invite them now to the Spirit who renews and to the Savior who died for them. He has set forth a propitiation for all sin, and God through him beseeches them to be reconciled. Let them persist in contempt and unconcern no longer, for there is an event that will soon and surely overtake us, and which, if it find us unprepared, will excite not the wonder of curiosity, but the amazement of terror. Death is at our door, and let us not despise the Savior who came to destroy him, lest, when we hear his approaching footsteps and receive his last and awful summons, we grow pale and tremble and perish. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit my blog, westportexperiment.com, where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things reformed.